Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. The recent disastrous cold weather caused by a mass of polar air dropping into the southern United States led to devastating power outages in Texas, leading to the deaths of at least 59 people. And as is often the case, it was the most vulnerable among us, in terms of their socioeconomic status, that have suffered most. In California, the past few summers, power outages have caused hardships once again, impacting the most disadvantaged populations. Extremes of heat and cold are part of a changing climate that has and will continue to stress our infrastructure. In this show, we talk to Washington Post reporter William England, who covers energy issues, about what happened in Texas and bigger picture implications for the national power grid. Then we'll be joined by UC Davis researchers Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro, who are part of a new study that shows how Black and Latinx populations in cities are disproportionately affected by heat, at times with deadly consequences. Our first guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter William England. England has served three tours as a Moscow correspondent for the Post and now is serving as a business energy correspondent. His recent reporting on the Texas power failures and the hazardously sub-freezing weather drew attention to how vulnerable the power grid is there, as well as in other places like California, which has had to deal with rolling blackouts and public safety power shutoffs during an increasingly long fire season. England joined us from his home in Baltimore, Maryland. Will England, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I saw your article the other day, and I read it, and I was just astounded by what I saw there. So I'd like to start out by asking you, how did this happen? What is going on in Texas with their power grid system, and how is it different from other states? Because as I understand, Texas does its own thing.
Texas very much does its own thing. And Texas is really into that. So they have their own electrical grid. The rest of the country is divided. The rest of the 48 states are divided into two grids, and Texas makes the third all by itself. And what happened when this really bitterly cold weather hit over the weekend was that people naturally cranked up their thermostats. A lot of people have electric heat in their houses. It put a huge demand for power on the utilities, far more than anticipated, which, you know, raises some questions. And even as they were doing that, however, one generating plant after another began to fall offline because the cold was causing them to seize up and you know, their equipment was freezing and they couldn't produce electricity. So demand was going up and the output was going down. So the dispatchers of the system began telling utilities they had to, the phrase is shed load, they had to cut customers off in order to save electricity for essential uses in order to keep the whole system from crashing. So that's what happened. And you may have noticed that there were about 4 million households without electricity in Texas on Tuesday. And there were a couple of thousand in neighboring Oklahoma where the weather was just as bad and where otherwise conditions are much the same. It was quite a contrast, and a lot of it has to do with Texas wanting to go it alone all the time.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the ironically named Electric Reliability Council of Texas, or ERCOT. This is not the first time that this has happened, is it? Because I saw that in 2011, they had a cold weather event, and they did a report about it, how they needed to harden their infrastructure against the cold. And then I was looking through your article and saw this is like the eighth time this kind of thing, although this one's pretty extreme. Since 1983, you know, not 1883, 1983, we've had, you know, Texas has had these events. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Texas is not immune to winter, even though it often likes to pretend that it is. So these cold weather events come fairly often. The interesting thing in 2011, after they'd had all these rolling blackouts and everything, and people were wondering, you know, what was wrong, everyone was shaking their head sadly because there had been a report after a very similar event in 1989. And the report had said, you know, we've got to harden the system and everything. And that had been ignored. And now we've learned that the report after the 2011 event was also pretty much ignored. So shaking heads again in Texas.
I'm guessing they'll do another report.
They've already promised to do one. The people who actually will do it are with the federal regulatory body, even though they don't have jurisdiction over Texas. This won't be an investigation. It won't be a set of orders. It'll just be recommendations.
Yeah, and again, so in Texas, electrons do not cross the state border the way they do, like in California. So when did they decide that that's the way they wanted to do things, and why?
1935, it turns out. 1935, it turns out. Texas utilities were already kind of interconnected. And when President Roosevelt signed the law organizing federal regulations over utilities, they struck a deal with the White House and were opted out, and they've been out ever since. Texas has always felt, you know, we've got a lot of energy here, and we've got plenty of ability to turn that energy into electricity, and we don't need the rest of the country. And we're very happy not to be connected to the rest of the country because this enables us to escape federal jurisdiction. Now, they do have some links to the U.S., to the rest of the U.S., but they're relatively minor.
Well, and you think of Texas, and of course you think of the petroleum industry and all of the natural gas they have there. What has been the problem with being able to use their natural gas for power generation?
Well, unlike fuel oil, which power plants in New England keep on site during the wintertime as a backup in case their gas lines fail, gas is more difficult to store. And once it's in storage, which is typically deep underground, you need pumps and everything to get it out and get it to the power plant, and the pumps freeze. And there's some moisture mixed with the gas, and that freezes. And diesel engines that might get the thing running again won't start in the cold, and it all kind of, you know, freezes up.
Yeah, and of course, watching the media, as I do, there's been a lot of quick to condemn the Green New Deal. You know, it's the fault of these wind turbines that have frozen up. That's not quite true, is it?
That's not quite true. That's a very good way of putting it. Yes, some wind turbines did freeze up. And by the way, you know, the technology to keep them from freezing does exist. And most northern countries that have wind turbines use it. But Texas does not, because Texas thinks of itself as immune to winter. But in any case, some power was lost from wind, but the amount that was lost was nowhere near as large as the amount that was lost as the gas-fired plants went offline. That was the big hit.
Yeah, but it's a convenient scapegoat. It's blame the Green New Deal, because if we get more renewables, then this is what could happen. You'll have no power. You'll freeze to death. Interesting way of putting it. And what fascinates me is, as you mentioned, and I know you spent some time as a correspondent in Moscow, Northern European countries, Alaska, you know, they deal with these kinds of temperatures all the time and don't have these problems. Like you said, it's the fact that Texas has decided that winter is an anomaly.
Yesterday, I checked with the Siberian city of Yakutsk, and it was minus 34 there, and they had the power on.
Yeah. When I mentioned to a friend in Northern Europe just yesterday what was going on in Texas, and he said, well, yeah, that's the temperature here all the time.
Yeah. Now, I would just say, you know, people make the argument, and it's not, you know, it's not ridiculous, that mostly they don't have weather like this, and is it worth spending the money to be prepared for weather like this? And there are people who say, yeah, it is, because an event like this causes a lot of damage and lives are lost, and there's a big financial hit as well.
Yeah, I would imagine if you look at the big picture, a long period, and make the investment over a long period of time, it would pay off in the long run when you don't have to deal with these. And, you know, which brings us to the bigger picture of the entire infrastructure of the United States. When we look at the state of the infrastructure, the electrical grid, as it's called, is it in bad shape? What do you think of the overall state of the United States electrical system?
Well, it is essentially a 20th century system. Most of the time, it works quite well for us. There is one problem that is specific to Texas and shared by California, which you recall had its own problems with electricity last summer in the heat rather than the cold. And that is that the financial structure in those states does not factor in what they call a capacity building portion of payments. In other words, there isn't a little surcharge that allows the power generating companies to build up capacity against a day like, or a couple of days like we've just had in Texas. So other states have that. And it requires, of course, more highly regulated sector than you have in Texas. But that's one of the pitfalls that is specific to, as I said, to Texas and California. The other thing, of course, to keep in mind is that, you know, we're on the verge of great big changes in our electric demand and our electric use. If we go to all electric cars, and you'll remember that General Motors has said that's all they're going to make after 2035, that's both a gigantic, you know, sort of drain, a demand on electric power, but also it's going to be very, very widely dispersed. It's not like you can build a power plant that can run a steel mill, you know, which is next door or something. You're going to have to get a lot of power out all across the country. And people are thinking that the grid is a little bit too old-fashioned of an idea for that. And we need to move into analytics and, you know, artificial intelligence and the electric equivalent of data clouds and that sort of thing. I'm not sure I quite understand how that's going to turn out, but clearly something is going to be very different quite soon in our entire power system.
Yeah, well, it will have to be. And that also brings me to some of the other vulnerabilities we have. We, of course, you know, here in California with PG&E, and you mentioned that earlier, you know, I saw a quote in your article from Ed Herz from the University of Houston that, you know, what happened in California and Texas is, you know, tragic but predictable with the deaths here last summer. We had power outages, and of course, PG&E has caused some of the great fires. You know, the fire that burned down my hometown of Paradise, California, and killed over 80 people was caused by, you know, electrical transmission lines were just woefully out of date. And the infrastructure here is just, and it's such a vast area, you know, and people say, well, put the power lines underground. Well, you're talking about power lines stretching over hundreds and hundreds of miles of terrain. That's, you know, it's very expensive to do that. So the vulnerabilities that we have, especially in California, but also apparently in Texas and other places, to extreme weather, you know, extreme heat waves and extreme cold. Could you talk a bit about, you know, the vulnerabilities that we have due to climate change, if you will?
Well, if these events become regular things, then obviously systems will have to be built to contend with them. So Texas will need a system more like Minnesota's than it has right now. And defending against fire is a little bit more difficult of an option. But one thing that people talk about is, as we move away from the old-fashioned grid, there may be much less sort of centralization in production. So you might have more but smaller power generating units scattered around, and you know, you would mostly be drawing your power from a local wind turbine, for instance, rather than from a giant plant halfway across the state. So that could perhaps cut down somewhat on the hundreds and hundreds of miles of transmission line, but it's hard to think that you'd actually get rid of that stuff.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post energy and business reporter William England, as we talk about what went wrong with the power grid in Texas during the recent freezing weather and its implications for the national power grid infrastructure. Let's take a short break, but stay with us. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to my conversation with Washington Post reporter Will England about the failures of the power grid in Texas and its national implications. Another thing that came to mind is we had the hack that went on last year from apparently from Russia, where they, you know, gained access to all kinds of different systems, from, you know, federal emails to nuclear power plants to energy systems. How vulnerable is our electrical grid system to hacking from some, you know, bad actor?
I suspect it's probably quite vulnerable. It's an awful question to consider, and I know a lot of people in the security world are extremely concerned about it. We haven't, you know, apparently had any hostile attacks yet on the power system. You know, I hope we never do.
Yeah, that's worrisome. Another vulnerability we have, I don't know if you've ever considered, is a solar storm. There was one that happened in the 1800s, where before we were electrified, where, you know, the charged particles from the sun were so energetic that they fried the telegraph system, you know, along the railroads, and caused auroras to be visible in places like Texas, you know, that far south. And I've seen some reports that if something like that were to happen with our modern, semi-modern, as you pointed out, energy system, that could be quite disastrous.
It could be. Let me tell you about something. In Texas, there's an organization called the Texas Reliability Entity. And the Texas Reliability Entity is a nonprofit that is supposed to monitor the electric regulatory Council of Texas, ERCOT, we were talking about before. So the Texas Reliability Entity has nothing on their website to speak of about snowstorms or cold weather, but there is, they have done quite a lot of study about just what you're talking about, the electrical storms. I don't mean thunderstorms.
Space weather, yeah.
Space weather. Will any of those recommendations be paid attention to? If they're anything like the recommendations following the cold events of 1989 and 2011, I don't think they will be. So there has to be a will there to do that. And by the way, the Texas Reliability Entity had to call off its meeting yesterday because the building where they meet was out of power.
Well, not ironic, but not surprising. The other tragic thing is how many people this affects people on the margins of society so dramatically. People that can afford to have a home generator outside and have stockpiled gasoline and can run their whole house on it and have wood stoves and, you know, have fireplaces, you know, they're okay. But some people who rely just on the electrical grid system as their only source of heat, this is not the kind of thing like a hurricane where you can just, okay, let's evacuate and drive away. This cold weather event is covering a vast region. And so these people are trapped. And so they resort to desperate measures. There's been a lot of, I've seen carbon monoxide poisonings.
Yes, yes. And another element to this, based on reporting on the ground in Texas, is that it seems peculiarly as if the more well-to-do communities have not had their power cut off and the less well-to-do communities have. So, it's not hard to imagine that there's something going on there. But, it's hitting the people hardest who perhaps have the fewest resources to deal with it.
Yeah, so they resort to, using charcoal briquettes to try to, warm their home. And, yeah, that gives off carbon monoxide gas. Or they sit in the car and run the heater, not knowing, that snow could be blocking the tailpipe or even worse, they're in a garage. And it's just tragic.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, as a financial reporter, what are some of the things that you're seeing, as we prepare for this future economy based more and more on renewables and on electrified automobiles, on electric cars? What are some of the signs you're seeing from, the energy sector of preparing for that and investing in it?
Well, you have Shell Oil of the Netherlands announcing that they think they have passed peak oil for their company, that they in the years ahead, they will be selling less and less oil. You had Total, the French company, is in kind of much the same position. ExxonMobil, which is kind of the most, you know, conservative and of the major oil companies and the most resistant to change, even they announced last month that they've launched a $3 billion effort to do carbon capture from factories, hoping that they can continue to sell oil if they do that. But the bigger picture, of course, is that ExxonMobil was dropped from the Dow Jones Industrial Average last summer. The market value of Tesla is like equal to ExxonMobil and Chevron and ConocoPhillips all put together. You're seeing the oil companies really fading far more than they ever have before.
Wow. And that's astounding that Tesla's value is compared to those iconic oil companies. That's amazing to me.
Of course, that's Wall Street, you know.
That's Wall Street, yeah. Yeah, that's true. As we've seen lately, the Wall Street operates in a kind of a world all its own.
Yes, yeah.
Well, before I let you go, I appreciate you spending the time with us to explain what happened in Texas, and looking forward to next summer. You know, heat waves, you know, are probably on the horizon, just as they are every summer, but it's seemingly more and more so in places like California and in places like the Midwest. Do you think that these energy companies are, you know, starting to look at, you know, we really have to harden ourselves to prepare for, you know, providing electricity during these extreme weather events, hot and cold?
Well, they say they are. And certainly if you went to any energy company, you would find some group of people somewhere who are working diligently and sincerely on these issues. I guess the question, though, is whether there's the strong will in the boardroom to really act on this and push it. An event like the one we've seen in Texas, you know, if there is a teeny silver lining, it is that it might help push people further in that direction.
Well, Will, thanks for joining us today to explain to us what's going on with the energy situation in Texas and how that relates to the bigger picture of electricity generation across the United States, because it is an important topic. You know, when you take for granted, when you flip on the light switch or turn the thermostat up, that the heat or the air conditioning is going to come on. And when it doesn't, life comes to a screeching halt, and you suddenly realize, you know, people had to live this way 150 years ago, and it wasn't easy.
That's right. It sure wasn't.
The difference is they were prepared for it. They knew how to deal with it. They had a bit the ability to survive, you know, cold weather by, you know, having fireplaces and things like that. And some places just don't have that ability.
That's the big difference. Yes, exactly.
Thanks to our guest, Will England of the Washington Post. We now turn our attention to another form of deadly temperature extreme, heat. Specifically, high temperatures associated with cities and their adverse effect on the health and welfare of vulnerable urban populations. Our guests are Professor Stephen Wheeler and doctoral candidate Jake D'Alessandro from the Department of Human Ecology at UC Davis. They recently were part of a team studying the effects of heat in 20 southwestern U.S. cities and how they disproportionately affect populations in the Black and Latinx communities. They both joined me from UC Davis. Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
First, let's talk about the basics of the urban heat island effect and how it's such an important issue in our warming world. Explain to us what the urban heat island effect is.
So the urban heat island is an interesting dynamic because it behaves differently depending on like what climate you live in. So if you're in like the city of Las Vegas or like the city of St. Louis, they're going to behave very differently just because of like the atmospheric parameters. So long story short with the urban heat island is there's a increase in impervious surface, which tends to have more greater absorption of downwelling solar irradiance, which means that it emits the energy that it collects from the sun very slow, which heats up the local atmosphere and the local air temperature, as well as the surface. If you were to compare that to something like, you know, like a desert that had like a lot of sand, that had high reflectivity, the heat would bounce off right away and wouldn't necessarily accumulate over time. Or if you had what was optimal, maybe like a green space, like a, or a forest, a natural setting, you know, it has less of that absorption component, and it will cool off more rapidly. So it basically results in like temperatures that can be 10, 12 degrees Celsius warmer, and then quite a few more degrees warmer Fahrenheit than the surrounding undisturbed landscape. So if it's an 80 degree day, let's say in Sacramento, an area that is in heavy impervious surface, heavy urban, could be like 95, 96 degrees.
Well, you know, we often hear about minority and poorer populations being disadvantaged in terms of living near, like, for example, petrochemical plants and things like that. But it never occurred to me that there's also an aspect of heat stress, or as you call it in the title of your paper, dimensions of thermal inequity, neighborhood social demographics, and urban heat in the southwestern U.S. I'd never realized before that there was this inequity. What was the impetus for this study?
So it was kind of honestly emerged the way that you described, like how you understood how like these vulnerable communities are located in areas that are like disproportionately impacted by environmental hazards. You know, so you mentioned a chemical plant. The neighborhood that I grew up in Cleveland was like a food desert. So it was we had this this food burden that was an inequity where we lived. And it turns out that heat is very similar. If you go to any city, there's, you know, very nice garden suburbs. That's like a term that Dr. Wheeler actually coined in one of his papers, where like, you know, you go in and it's almost like you're in a garden that just happens to have houses in it. And then you go, unfortunately, to areas of the neighborhood or neighborhoods in the same city that are poorer, and it's, you know, a concrete jungle, or there's a lack of vegetation, lack of shade, and all those things. So basically the impetus for this was exploring like, well, does heat behave the same way these other environmental hazards do? The way the air quality in the San Joaquin Valley sometimes influences vulnerable communities more. And we wanted to know if it was consistent throughout the entire U.S., if it was something that just happened in the San Joaquin County, something that just happened in Northern or Southern California, or is it consistent no matter what city in the Southwestern U.S. you're at? And we did the Southwestern U.S., one, because we study at the University of California, Davis. I have spent a lot of time in the Southwestern United States, and it's an understudied region when it comes to urban heat islands, which for the most part is pretty heavily studied, but dryland climates, so any climate that's like Mediterranean or desert or semi-arid, those are all very understudied. And a lot of these cities haven't had a chance to really like see what's going on, because like cities like El Paso and Albuquerque have very low amounts of funding to even research this kind of thing. And if they do, even less money to mitigate it.
Yeah. Stephen, could you explain to us who was on this team that did the study?
Yes, it's myself, Jake, another faculty member in our community and regional development program, NOLI Brazil, and a colleague from Lebanon, Yasser Abu Nasser. And we have actually worked with him on several previous studies related to urban heat, and also the role of greening cities, increasing vegetation in reducing heat. And we have looked particularly at Dubai, and we had some funding from a source there in past work. So it was the four of us.
Let's talk about the data you used. I saw that Landsat was kind of the primary data collector. Can you explain to us, you know, how you use those measurements? How was that used to make this study, and like over what time period? And I'm most interested in like what kind of data were you looking for? Like cloudless days when it's like the hottest days? What?
So yeah, like we did use Landsat 8 imagery. So it's an operational land imager that was launched in the early 2010s. And it's the eighth generation of the Landsat satellite. And the great thing about it is it captures data every 16 days of the same area. And it lets you capture the whole city at once, like a snapshot in time. The great thing also about it is it not only captures like the visible light, so you can look at this image and see the city, you can see the urban-rural boundary, but it collects data in the near-infrared, the shortwave infrared, and the thermal-infrared portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. And this kind of gets into light physics, but it's basically light that we cannot see. And the thermal portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, Landsat actually has two bands, which is like channels of imagery that's taken. And we used one of the bands and used an algorithm to convert the thermal energy eventually to surface temperature. And we did this through using a thing called emissivity, which is about basically a ratio of how much is reflected or how much is emitted by a surface when it comes to the thermal portion of the spectrum. And basically the downwelling and upwelling radiance, which is essentially how much energy is coming down, how much energy is going out. It's funny that you mentioned cloud-free days. Cloudiness is like there's like a funny meme out there that's like a picture of someone flying on an airplane. And it says like, how do you make satellites cry? And it's just a picture of a bunch of clouds. In the southwestern United States, you know, it's a very cloudless area, especially in California in the summer. So we actually didn't have too much trouble. A little bit with the cities of Houston and Dallas and San Antonio, we had some trouble finding some cloud-free days. But we were looking for an average summer heat day. So, you know, a day that fell within like the middle median of temperature for any given summer day. But then we also looked for the hottest available imagery. And we classified that as an extreme heat event. Because if these vulnerabilities and these thermal inequities exist, they're only amplified when an extreme heat event happens. So we looked at two scenarios, and really three, if you think about nighttime imagery. Landsat is not the best at capturing nighttime imagery, mainly because it can't collect the emissivity value because the sensor is not sensitive enough at night. It's only sensitive enough to collect temperature. But fortunately for researchers out there, the International Space Station has launched EcoStress, which is a new satellite that also captures nighttime temperature at a much higher accurate resolution. And hopefully in a future publication that we do, we'll be using EcoStress temperature for nighttime.
What kind of resolution do you have with this data? Are we talking down to like a neighborhood, a block, what?
Actually, beneath that. So the Landsat data provides data at a 30 by 30 meter resolution, so a 900 square meter pixel. So like a lot of that data is really, really useful because it can actually go between blocks. Like one block can have, let's say, 15 Landsat temperature pixels. So you can see the variation within a block. But then when it comes to the city, you can really see a variation. If you look at a thermal footprint of, say, the Coachella Valley, so Palm Springs, Cathedral City, you can actually perfectly pick out where the golf courses are from this imagery because it's so fine resolution. In the future, hopefully it will get better, even more precise.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we'll continue our conversation with UC Davis researchers Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro about their recent study of how urban heat islands disproportionately affect Black and Latinx communities. I'm Dave Shlom, and this is Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's continue now with our conversation with UC Davis researchers Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro about the effects of heat in urban areas on the poor, particularly in Black and Latinx communities. I'd like to know, maybe you could address this, Stephen, about the methodologies used to determine and quantify, you know, how heat is disproportionately affecting these neighborhoods, these communities. Tell us a bit, you know, without getting too far into the weeds for those of us who are not, you know, too up on the math, but tell us about the numbers behind this and some of the variables you had to account for.
Well, we basically used U.S. Census data. So we had the thermal data, the heat data from satellite at a quite high spatial resolution. The census is not quite so high resolution. It uses census tracts and block groups. But we are able at that scale to look at income and racial and ethnic background and other things like that, educational levels, et cetera. And our strategy was to look at the poorest neighborhoods, the poorest 10% of neighborhoods. and compare those with the wealthiest 10%. And what we found is that on average, the poorest neighborhoods are 4 degrees Fahrenheit hotter on a summer day, both on an average summer day and on a extreme heat day, than the rich neighborhoods. And that was the average across all 20 metro areas in the southwestern U.S. For some of them, it's greater. And that's a pretty big disparity. And we have to remember that heat kills. In any large heat wave, dozens or hundreds or sometimes even thousands of people will die. The 2003 heat wave in France killed 15,000 people, most of them in Paris. In Chicago, there was a heat wave that killed 800 in 1995. And those are just two that have actually been studied. The same as with COVID. You look at the excess mortality during that period. It will be primarily elderly folks and people who are vulnerable anyway, who are sick or have disabilities. And the poor will suffer the most because they often are in rental housing. They won't have good air conditioning, or their AC will go out and their landlord won't fix it in a timely manner. So based on that, the upbeat message from this study is that we can prepare for these types of events in the future, and we're going to have to prepare as a society. And we're going to have to, first of all, reduce heat in those neighborhoods by planting trees, drought-tolerant trees in these types of cities, by reducing asphalt in every place possible, and also by using built form to create more shade at the ground level, which obviously improves human comfort. We will also need to do other public health interventions, such as open cooling centers, and perhaps give people in not very good rental housing assistance in getting cooling, working with their landlords or improving the energy efficiency of their building to day after day of high temperatures, which wears people down.
Yeah. And just an obvious question, what accounts for the actual temperature differences between these neighborhoods and, say, you know, affluent ones?
It's generally a lot more green and less asphalt proportionally. In California particularly, which has had cheap or even free water, the wealthy neighborhoods have been able to take advantage of that. And they're the ones that can hire the landscape crews and the designers and do beautiful lawns and yards for themselves. The street trees are way better in those neighborhoods. The cities often historically have, you know, done a bit more in terms of keeping up parks and creating parks in those neighborhoods, which help cool the neighborhood. So there's longstanding inequity, which ties back to a lot of the racial and class issues that have come to the...
Yeah, you mentioned in your paper, you mentioned redlining. And for those of us not familiar with that term, could you explain it and its implications for how this creates these heat concentration areas? So I saw, for example, it was like a staggering 94% of these redlined communities showed, you know, higher temperatures.
Yes. Historically, back in the early to mid 20th century, banks and other agencies, including the federal government, literally drew red lines around neighborhoods of color with high percentages of Black and Latino and other ethnic and racial groups. And they often did not give loans to homeowners in those places, to people to buy homes, to homeowners to maintain or upgrade homes. And those areas were often neglected by cities. They had disinvestment of many different types. Businesses left, tax base left, so that suburbs were able to do wonderful parks and landscape treatments, which cool them in the long run, whereas the old central city neighborhoods didn't have the resources to do that.
I also saw something, you know, that looked kind of interesting in the data. Was there a significant difference between Black communities and Latinx communities in the cities?
You know, that's interesting that you saw that, because that's something that we uncovered as well. We don't know if it is a function of the overwhelming Latinx populations that are in these southwestern United States cities. I personally would hypothesize that you would see a greater disparity than we found if you were to take 20 biggest cities in the Midwest. So if you were going to do Chicago, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Memphis, if you were going to do those cities, I think the demographics would shift, but the pattern that we found would be the same. What we found in California is that Latinx populations tend to hold the greatest amount of burden to urban heat. That doesn't mean to say that other populations that could be, you know, Native American, Asian, or Black populations, that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't facing an unequal thermal inequity, but what we found it to be not quite as steep as that the Latinx communities were facing. And we believe that's a function of lower overall percent of the population.
And I'm curious what might be, you know, the causes for that? Why would that be different? What would cause that there to be a difference between a Latinx neighborhood and a Black neighborhood? Any ideas?
Good question. I wish I knew the answer, honestly, at this moment. I think there's a lot of potential ideas, like, but I can't think of any specific reason why that particular population is more is targeted. Or no, I shouldn't say targeted, but is facing an unequal burden. And I don't, like, if you look at like the income, for example, the what Dr. Wheeler explained about how, okay, there's more impervious surface, there's way less tree canopy, there's way less irrigation in general. You know, that goes hand in hand. That's easy to see. But when you look at these two, when you look at like the differences between one census block group, let's say that's 85% African American, and the census block group across town that's 75% Latino, we haven't figured out why the Latinx block group is still so much warmer than its Caucasian counterpart.
If I can speak to that a little bit, for most of these cities, the Black population is pretty small, and it may be slightly more dispersed. So I think that's probably the primary reason here. Like, I used to live in Albuquerque and teach at the University of New Mexico, and the Black population tends to be clustered around the Air Force base there, which is partly how they came in as service people, and then they decided to stay. And that just happens to be a higher neighborhood, which tends to be a little bit cooler. So there's going to be some geographical factors that come in here too. For example, in the LA basin, South Central is fairly heavily Black, but it's also much closer to the Pacific Ocean than many of the Latino neighborhoods. So there is some noise in the data, particularly when you have smaller populations. Now, Latinx populations are very large, you know, close to 50% or more in many of these cities. So we are getting very good data on those. And the highest 10% on Latinx census variables are going to be very concentrated poor communities in which we're going to see that difference show up strongly.
And one thing I was interested in looking at some of your other papers about urban heat island effects is that there are different kinds of urban landscapes. Could you describe some of those different landscapes to us? Like what you see, you know, from space, for example, with this imagery, how you see, you know, in different cities, you see different types of landscapes and how those can affect, you know, the retention of heat.
In dryland cities, i.e. arid and semi-arid cities, heat islands actually function a bit differently than they do in temperate cities like Atlanta. And they actually can be less pronounced. Atlanta, you have a cool woodland basically all around the city. Lots of vegetation with lots of moisture transpiring. And so there's going to be a big difference between that and the relatively small urban part, which heats up a lot. A desert city, the desert heats up pretty rapidly itself. So you don't often get as strong a heat island, urban heat island effect. And you may actually have the city be cooler in the daytime if it has a fair bit of vegetation in it than the surrounding desert. But what matters is this heat is still high. It's going to harm people. And the disparities between neighborhoods are high, which means that disadvantaged folks suffer the most. And as a society, we don't want that to happen. There are many other geographical factors that come into this. Elevation is one. Proximity to large bodies of water, like the Pacific Ocean. Proximity to agricultural land. If you have a lot of irrigated farm fields, that is going to cool down the neighborhoods right next to that. And Jake, probably you can add some others to that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned like what would you be looking down on, like maybe from like a bird's eye view. I think Dr. Wheeler gave a really good baseline for what you would see. Let's take Fresno, for example. If you're looking down at the city of Fresno, you can look at where the agriculture is and just honestly make a very educated guess on what the income is going to be. If you look in areas that are heavily populated, maybe like the Inland Empire, for example, which would be Riverside, San Bernardino, you look down and you see the green spaces and then the higher foothill elevation of the mountain range that's there. The name escapes me at the moment, but like if you look towards like the El Cajon Pass, you go up in elevation, you're getting a little bit cooler, you're having a little bit more vegetation, but you're also going up in income. This is something that we found in the Denver metropolitan area, the Salt Lake City metropolitan area, the San Jose metro area, and then in the California cities, which include San Jose, but also San Diego and LA, you also have like this proximity to large bodies of water. So the more income you make, you're closer to the bodies of water. You have the cooling from the Pacific, you have more green vegetation and less impervious surface. So if you look down, you see an airport and just like a concrete jungle, that's going to be really warm. Even in desert climates, it's going to be really warm. But if you take like the city of Palm Springs or the city of Phoenix, for example, the city itself actually has more vegetation than the surrounding landscape, but it's unequally distributed between groups. Whereas one neighborhood is just like, you would not know if you were in Phoenix or Miami with how much vegetation there is. It's like palm trees, royal date palms, those are everywhere. You have all these vegetation that shouldn't be growing that's taking massive amounts of water, but they're only in the neighborhoods that can afford that massive amount of water.
And what about a city like Sacramento? Like, how does that compare to these other cities, you know, since it's the closest one to us?
Great example too, because it's almost like a hybrid. It has a little bit of Fresno in it, where like if you're surrounding like the agricultural areas, you may be, you know, more of an ex-urban suburban home. And then Sacramento is also very interesting because the American River Parkway is like a spine of, you know, cooler temperatures because it provides this great linear green space. And in Sacramento is interesting because it's a mixed bag of demographics along that linear green space. In some areas like Fair Oaks, it's very high income. It's very, the more wealthy live there. You get closer to Sacramento by Exposition Boulevard or even in the Rancho Cordova area. And those areas are nowhere near as wealthy as surrounding landscape or surrounding neighborhoods further away. So Sacramento is actually one of the most perplexing ones of our 20 city analysis. And you can see in the paper that it actually had the lowest urban heat magnitude based on our demographic comparison of means. And I think that's a function of it having multiple dynamics. One, absolutely no western suburbs because the causeway has no potential for expansion because of the causeway is there. And two, because we have like all these other dynamics, the river and agriculture throughout the city.
And the Delta breeze in the summertime, which acts as a natural air conditioner.
Yeah, that's a great point. Exactly. Yeah.
That being said, though, I think if you looked at Land Park, which is a wealthy old late 19th, early 20th century close-in neighborhood, the epitome of the garden suburb, and you looked at South Sacramento, which is only a couple miles further south, but very much poorer, heavily people of color, you would find on a typical day on the order of 6 to 7 degrees temperature difference.
Looking forward, what are some, you know, you mentioned the list a little bit earlier, but kind of bring it around for us. What are some of the potential solutions for these communities as they become aware of the fact that there is this heat disparity? What are some things that they can do for themselves and we can all do to help make these places a little more habitable?
You know, there's a lot to be done. And unfortunately, in California, not only is there, you know, like a lack of obviously funding, but there's like a lack of like, you know, natural resources in water. ideally, in a perfect world, we would just plant trees everywhere that there's not enough trees in Sacramento. And it would legitimately cool things dramatically. It would provide a great ecosystem service, carbon sequestering. The temperatures would drop. People would have shade. But we don't like live in that perfect world. There are a lot of cheaper ways to mitigate temperature and make things more inhabitable, as you said. A high albedo, which means high reflectivity. So instead of having like a roof that's like black tar, you would maybe put like a lighter material so there's more reflectance into the atmosphere and less accumulation of this heat. You could do drought-resistant planting. So like, you know, these trees that are already accustomed to not getting as much water but still provide the ecosystem services that trees provide. And then, you know, configuration, like it's configuration of all of the above. So like you can obviously plant a tree or plant a number of trees or plant a green space, but the shape and the form of it will influence how much it cools. If it's linear, it's not going to cool as much as if it's a big wide polygon, so to speak, of green space. If it's more of a checkered approach, you can at least break up the heating by putting like, by breaking up the continuum of impervious surface and asphalt parking lots and high density buildings. But yeah, there's just a number of things we can do. And hopefully we'll continue to find more ways to mitigate this to make it the most habitable for everyone that lives there.
Well, Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro from UC Davis, thanks for joining us and shedding some light and hopefully not any heat on this important topic.
Thank you so much, Dave.
We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to our guests, Washington Post reporter William England and UC Davis researchers Stephen Wheeler and Jake D'Alessandro. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, which is a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.